It's spring and you want to hike, bike, hit up the farmer's market, but the last thing you want to do on a warm, sunny morning is clean house. That's where Greenland Pro Cleaning comes in. They're eco-friendly, allergy-friendly, and locally owned in Asheville. Listeners of The Overlook get a free upholstery and refrigerator cleaning upgrade with their first booking. Just use the code PODCAST at checkout. Make the most of your time this spring and visit greenlandprocleaning.com/overlook. What if Jesus were resurrected today as a stand-up comedian? Well, he might sound a lot like Robert Duback when he brings his stand-up Jesus to the Wortham Center for the Performing Arts. The creator of the Book of Mormon is back to spread his gospel about false prophets and duplicitous politicians while redeeming sinners of all faiths. Catch Stand-Up Jesus 8 p.m. May 3rd and 4th at the Wortham Center. Find details and tickets at worthamarts.org.
I am a maker, a builder, a baker, although sometimes my messes are all that you'll find. I'll tell a story, both true and allegorical. The process is precious, though it takes up all my time.
You want to know what's happening with McCormick Field, Thomas Wolfe Auditorium, or the Western North Carolina Nature Center? My guest has all the answers. Well, most of them.
The larger capacity of the baseball stadium, I think it's very realistic for us to be able to put 10 plus shows in there a year. Now, we committed to the neighborhood not to do more than 15 loud shows a year.
So you're not going to be hosting a Slayer residency?
As much fun as that would be. No, I don't think so.
This is The Overlook with Matt Pikin, a podcast about the news, arts, issues, and trends of Asheville, North Carolina. Chris Coral is general manager and director of community and regional entertainment facilities for the city of Asheville. We go into detail about the upcoming trip around the bases for McCormick Field's renovation, including what's being done to turn the stadium into a year-round facility. We also go through changes at the Nature Center, the city's municipal golf course, and how the city managed to patch Thomas Wolfe up enough to get back into business. Will the deeper renovations needed or completely new facility ever happen there? I asked that question too. I began my conversation by asking Chris about the timeline for renovating McCormick Field.
We're finishing design right now, but literally like the day after the last game, things are going to start moving over at McCormick Field, and we're going to be under construction essentially for 2 years straight. So we'll work through the first off season. 2025 season will be at reduced capacity in some way, shape, or form while we do construction around baseball. We'll work through the season. Baseball will still exist. We'll work a full off season, and then we'll open April of 2026 with a renovated stadium.
So all of the renovations happening at McCormick will happen during off seasons.
Some will happen during the 2025 season. So that's why we'll have that reduced capacity around baseball. We're going to try to be working outside of the main seating bowl and the left field and right field areas. But really, if we have to affect the total capacity or close a restroom or close a concession stand to keep the project moving, timeline's the most important thing. And the team understands that. So if we have to reduce the total number of tickets they can sell in order to keep the project moving, that's what we're going to do.
So describe piece by piece, not granularly necessarily, but what will be different fundamentally about McCormick Field once the renovations are complete?
Oh boy. So first and foremost, it's going to be Major League Baseball Player Development League compliant, which means that it's going to have locker rooms and player facilities that meet just minimum requirements, which we're not even close to right now. And that means enough lockers for all the players, training space, coach and umpire rooms, both for male and female. Right now, we only have shared restrooms and locker rooms. So if we have a co-ed officials crew, they share a room, which is awkward, right?
Yeah.
So that'll be the main thing that most people won't see, right? Because you don't get to go into the player's locker room. We're going to add a club space, which will be like box suites, but that'll be a 12-month-a-year space so that we'll be able to do banquets and other events in that space. There'll be a new scoreboard, new outfield wall, a big picnic area in the left field, along the left field line, which should be good for about 250 people as like a group sales space. We're going to renovate the existing right field building, which is where the ticket office and the main entry is, and it's where the only box suite is currently. So that box suite will continue to exist. The tourist office space is in there. It'll be a new team store that'll be renovated. That building will be expanded a bit to allow for a new ticket entry. And then the gate entry system there, right now you have to come in the stadium, buy your tickets, go back out, come back in to get scanned in. It's really awkward. So there'll be, I think it's a total of 8 gates that'll be available. So you buy your tickets, come in the stadium. The entry plaza is almost triple the size of what it is currently. And field improvements, the drainage, irrigation, playing surface will all be updated. The netting that protects you from getting hit by an errant ball or bat, that's going to be fully replaced and will be extended foul pole to foul pole, which is a new safety requirement by MLB. We'll have some ADA accessible upgrades throughout the seating bowl, and we're hoping to work in the ability to renovate every existing bathroom. That's going to be what we call an ad alternate, just with how the budget is. It's everything is more expensive than it should be right now. So we're trying to figure out what's going to stay in the budget and what's not going to stay.
You mentioned price, budget. This is a $32 million project. Is that what that's slated for?
Total budget on the project is actually $38 million, which includes design and everything. So our construction budget is right around $28 million. Once you factor in what we call FF&E, furnitures, fixtures, and equipment, design costs, permitting, all the other things that come with it. But we selected a construction manager at risk, a CMAR, which is Bloom Construction, that's running point in this project. And they're doing a great job so far. We hired them really early back in November so that as the design team is designing things, we can have the construction manager immediately telling us what the costs are to make sure we don't have any scope creep that gives us a challenge later in the budget. So that way we're never at a point that we're fully value engineering and we're just value engineering as we go. When they say, let's do this in the picnic area, and we're like, hey, that budget doesn't fit. Let's stop that before you get too far down the line.
Or could it be something where the team could decide, we want to add that, so we will foot that bill? Is the city's investment in this fixed?
It is. And actually, that's already happened. So originally, this was a $37.5 million project. As we got into the club suite and for what is the team's like really sellable asset to like the high end client or like a big business that wants to bring in 50 to 100 people in that club suite, we were having square footage issues to meet the budget. And so the team chipped in an extra $1 million upfront of cash on top of what we had already agreed upon. So it turned into a $38.5 million project, which is great.
Yeah. You mentioned a 12-month aspect in terms of these suites. And tell me if I'm right. And this reflects kind of year-round programming in McCormick, which was not really available to the community before that. Mm-hmm. What kind of renovations are being made to the field that would accommodate things that aren't baseball-related that are to optimize, let's say, concerts, mm-hmm. other types of events?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So right now, the stadium has to be winterized because of how the piping works. So water doesn't get turned on until a week before the first game, just in case. And then almost immediately after the last game, because we get into October and we have issues. So we're structuring it, all the piping, so that the stadium doesn't have to be winterized, which is step one to be able to do these off-season events. The club space will accommodate, depending on what our final design lands on, somewhere between 75 and 150 people in a banquet reception style event. And it directly connects to the batting cages. So our goal is to be able to do like corporate events that maybe have a lunch and like a little keynote address. And then they have some fun stuff where they can go take like hitting practice in the batting cage or even a birthday party, right? Like all kinds of fun stuff there. But then if you're doing an event out on the field, say, and you need like a reprise somewhere indoors in the summer, you can be on the field, go into the club room. We're also adding concert power, which is an amazingly high expense just to have a few thousand extra amps of power available. But this is 5-wire, 400 amp services to be able to plug in concert sound lights so that we can do concerts in the stadium. Hopefully somewhere between 10 and 15 dates a year on the concert side.
Yeah, right now, Asheville Rabbit is really the only outdoor venue that we have consistently for concerts here.
Don't forget about Salvage Station. However, that's they've true. Got some yeah. challenges with the
I-26
project.
Yeah, and that's going away eventually. Salvage Station is going to vanish with the eminent domain.
Yes, and Rabbit out there, I can't remember what the total noise ordinance cap is, but there's a maximum number of shows that any outdoor venue can do, and they're pretty close to that number already. And so with Salvage Station moving away, plus the larger capacity of the baseball stadium, I think it's very realistic for us to be able to put 10 plus shows in there a year. Now, we committed to the neighborhood not to do more than 15 loud shows a year. So even though we can do up to 30 some,
we're so you're not going to be hosting a Slayer residency there is what you're telling
as
me.
As much fun as that would be. No, I don't think so.
So what would the capacity, the concert capacity be at McCormick Field?
So our maximum capacity is actually up to 10,000 people. We're going to be targeting probably what we would call like a more boutique amphitheater size, somewhere between 4,500 and 8,000.
Mm. One thing we haven't really touched on is the concession area. I know from what I read, there's going to be an expanded thing, like more of a restaurant environment, at least with one vendor, or what are we looking at there? And I ask this too, because it seems like ballparks are becoming more entertainment centers where the game is the central attraction, but a lot of people go there and they shop and they eat, they plan dinners at ballparks and things like that. Is McCormick Field going to reflect that evolution?
It's not going to be like what you see at the Major League Baseball level. If you've been to Atlanta Stadium or PNC Park in Pittsburgh, is a really great example of an amazing ballpark. So restaurant would be a strong word. Like, you're not going to have a sit down space with wait service, but we're expanding the footprint. It's almost doubling the ability for what we call third party vendors to come in that can vend food. So we're expanding the options that are going to be able to be purchased at the stadium by doing so. But you're right. The baseball is almost secondary anymore at these, and same with basketball arenas and even football stadiums. Like, the game is the main event clearly, but a lot of the crowd that shows up doesn't see even half of the games anymore because you're doing all these other things, right?
And one of the things too is, you know, like, I know that minor league ballparks are having to be more competitive in that way. When I lived in Minnesota, the St. Paul Saints, the independent team, they have a state-of-the-art stadium. You wouldn't believe the offerings in there. And the store, it's a huge, glamorous store for the St. Paul Saints. And they're an unaffiliated minor league team. I was wondering if McCormick Field, looking at what else is happening, what is the shelf life of this renovated stadium to not need to be updated again?
The goal is that shelf life being at least 23 years, which is the length of our lease, and ideally closer to 30. The lease is technically up to 33 years, but the initial term is 23. 30 is our debt service on the project. We're trying to keep that historic feel, I don't know, the classic feel of the stadium, right? Like, you go into some of these and it's more entertainment than baseball. This stadium currently is more baseball than entertainment. That's going to be cyclical, right? So keeping the ability to be more classic, more baseball focused. If you go there on a Thursday night, like, sure, there's people just hanging out, having beer and just like talking to their friends, but they're still paying attention to the game. And so I think that's never going to leave, especially at the low A level where it is. But if the team for some reason bumps up to a double A or triple A, we're going to need to do something to have more entertainment around just because of what the fan expects with that level of baseball. But I think realistically, we're building things mostly to the Major League Baseball PDL standard minimums in a lot of cases, because we've told the Astros if they want to go over and above the minimum requirement, we need you to chip in. And so far in every area where that would be, they didn't want to add extra dollars in. So we'll probably stay in that low A level, which fits for our market size, but we could go up. It's always a possibility.
And is there potential for other revenue within that field that the city has not seen before for the city to be able to help recoup costs?
Definitely. So the extra events is first and foremost, right? The team has the right to bring in an event, own that event fully and operate it. All concerts are going to be owned by the city and or our co-promotion partners, which are the same that we use at the Harris Cherokee Center, Asheville. And we would own 50% of that revenue from the concerts if we're partnering with these other groups. And then the bar, the concessions, the team has to split with us 50-50 on the ancillary events. So that's new money to the city that's not factored into our debt service plan. So that's extra money that can go towards paying off the loan earlier or towards other future improvements that we might need at the stadium. Because let's be real, once we do the first four or five concerts, we're going to be like, we need this and this to do this better and make more money. And then by being able to turn that money back into the stadium, we'll be able to keep that cycle moving and not have a big lift like this one, hopefully in the future.
More after this. When you go to an Asheville City Soccer Club game, you're not just watching soccer. You're welcomed into what players and fans call the South Slope Blues.
the South Slope Blues. They're amazing.
This is the coach of the women's team, Brooke Bingham.
The atmosphere is what makes Asheville City Soccer so great.
Longtime player Laura Greb.
We have the most dedicated fans. We have our South Slope Blues. They post up in the corner of the field every game. They've got their drums, they've got their smoke, they've got their loud voices. You can hear them for miles.
Elite men and women players from throughout North Carolina team up in Asheville for a two-month season against other aspiring pros from all over the Southeast. Home games this season begin May 18th at Greenwood Field on the UNC Asheville campus. For details, tickets, and your first steps into the South Slope Blues, visit Asheville City Soccer Club at AshevilleCitySC.com. And this is just one of the, now it's the major project you have going. There are a few other things. The Western North Carolina Nature Center is another thing. Tell me about what's happening there. And renovations are imminent, or what's happening?
Yeah, so we're bidding that project. It's the Gateway to the Southern Appalachians is what we're calling it. And we'll be bidding that project here in the next couple of weeks. It's roughly a $1.3 million project. And if you've been to the Nature Center, we renovated the front entrance a few years back. So you come in and there's a barn and then you're in the farmyard. And so the space that we're working on is that farmyard area. So we've updated the entry. But if you go to any large zoo, SeaWorld, Disney World, whatever, you go through the ticket area and then you get to this big plaza and it's, that's where I'm going to plan my day and figure out what I'm going to do, right? And we don't have that at the Nature Center, and it's not huge, but it's big enough that you want to figure out how you want to route through and how much time you have. So this space will be updated. It'll move the barn animals onto the hillside, which are mostly goats and they're climbers and they like that anyway. And it creates this grand view over black bear, which is like the fundamental animal for Western North Carolina wildlife, right? That's what everybody thinks of. And then on the right, as you're walking in, we're going to be adding a butterfly garden and a small little greenhouse that we'll be able to grow chrysalises in and do some programs around pollinators and butterfly. And it's another step in the 2010-20 year master plan, which we're 14, 15 years into, which this will allow us to then move forward with the next step, which is redoing Black Bear. And there's a wooden boardwalk that's not quite ADA accessible now that we hope to update to make a full 360 route through the park that's fully ADA accessible. Right now we're grandfathered in a couple spots. And the beauty of this plaza space that will work day to day as that like entry, like grand feel moment for the guests is that in the evenings, the Friends of the Nature Center or Nature Center staff are going to be able to program that with events, and it won't affect the animals, which is nice because it's before you're getting into most of the animal space, but it'll also have direct view to the barnyard, the pollinator space, and bear. So without having to pull the animals out or affect them in times they're not used to people, we can program the space and generate more revenue towards the future.
The commonality we're talking about here between McCormick and the Nature Center is that there are a lot of other uses now that I imagine weren't even on the minds of the original people who founded the Nature Center. What has evolved in terms of the use of the Nature Center?
So the Friends of the Nature Center has really grown as a nonprofit that supports the Nature Center. For example, this $1.3 million project, they're putting $300,000 in. A little over $550,000 is coming from the Tourism Development Authority. And then the city's covering the balance, which is a similar, across all three of these projects that we're talking about, that's a similar model, right? The TDA city and then a third party. But the staff at the Nature Center over the years, in conjunction with the Friends, has seen this opportunity. They started what's called Bears and Brews, which is like a beer tasting thing in the evening at the Nature Center once a month in the summer, a few years back, and it's been really successful. And the fundraising that has come from that has made everybody realize, like, we need to do more events. And they have corporations that come out and they're like, we want to do like a employee picnic. We don't have space to put 50 employees, right? But by doing this, we will. And so that we can have your employee picnic in the evening. And if we do tours that go down through the park, the animals are really active as the sun's going down. Just think in your neighborhood, that's when you see the turkeys come out, right?
Yeah, the bear trash exhibit, the bear going through the trash exhibition happens in the middle of the night. Yeah.
The city tests the trash cans with our bear, like they bring them out.
Oh, they do?
Yeah. Check the city's Insta page. You'll see it every once in a while. There's a new trash can being tested and our bear tends to get in pretty easily.
That's really hysterical to me. I like the idea that of the bear looking forward to the day, oh, I'm going to break through this thing. So now we've talked a lot about the Nature Center, about enhancing the user experience in a way that wouldn't affect the animals, or at least minimally affect them. What's being done, or is anything being done, to expand wildlife offerings at the Nature Center?
Yeah, so we've had a lot of new animals come on exhibit this year, a lot of young cubs, and in fact, two cub mountain lions are coming out in the next week or so, which will be amazing. But red panda a few years ago was added in. So there's WNC Nature Center is focusing on animals in Western North Carolina, right? Red panda is clearly not out here now, but in the prehistoric times it was. So we have current nature, right? And then you have what we're calling, it's the Appalachian stream. So that's like your turtles, your hellbender salamander, snakes, amphibians. And then this prehistoric realm, which would include groups like anteater and rhino and red panda. And so the long term is to continue adding exhibits like that. And there's plenty of footprint and space. And to do that, we have to do all these other infrastructure needs. Like, we recently updated the animals' commissary, which is where we prepare their food, moved it to a new location with help from the Friends of the Nature Center, who contributed a little over $100,000 to that project, built that space. So we have this new commissary. We moved the vet clinic away from the front entry area so that we could then do these expansions to help do these corporate picnics. So it's all working together and tied to this master plan that's from 2010. And governments do master plans quite often, and they work for a while and then they steer away from them. This is a prime example of a master plan that was put into place that's still being followed almost 15 years later. Like, the Nature Center and the Friends of the Nature Center team are doing an amazing job out there staying with that plan.
Another big project you're doing, or at least, I don't know how big, but the municipal golf course. What's that project about?
Yeah, so that project is slightly bigger than the Nature Center project, actually. It's about $2.9 million in total funding that we've received so far, we had a goal of 3.2. That's funded 1.6 million roughly through the Tourism Development Authority, a million through the city, and then the rest we've pieced together with small grants, public, private donations, and really lots of movement there. We've actually gotten $60,000 from the Donald Ross Society Foundation. So we're restoring that course to the original Donald Ross design. So he's a world famous golf designer and golfer. That course was the first integrated golf course in the Southeast and home to the only surviving Black owned and operated professional golf tournament in the country. So there's a lot of history there. And it got into disrepair with the previous operator that was leased. They leased the course from City Parks and Rec. And so we, the city, had very little control over what they did. So we changed the agreement, got a new operator in. So we have an actual management risk in that. So we have say in what happens, but also we take risk return. So if it loses money, we're going to lose money. But if it makes it, we're going to make it, which gives us investment and the operator investment. So we have redone all 18 sets of tees, all 18 greens. We've regrassed multiple fairways. By the time we're done in May, we'll have restored 100% of the original designed bunkers, which are the sand traps. We've removed bunkers and sand traps that did not exist in the original design that just got added over time. And we're fixing just about 3/4 of a mile of stormwater piping that's coming. It's catching water from the Beverly Hills neighborhood on the golf course and getting it to the Swannanoa River, which had failed. And there were numerous sinkholes and other challenges. We've repaired or replaced all 18 holes with a golf cart pass. There was some really damaged areas. We did remove a good bit of trees. I cannot find anywhere else in the country that's doing this, but we're going to be starting a tree nursery program there. So on some of the ancillary space around golf, we're planting trees in conjunction with Asheville Greenworks. So our first set is going in this fall. It's going to be about 125 trees, I believe. And so those will cycle out. And as they grow, they'll get dug up and they'll be replanted and donated to municipal governments, nonprofits in Buncombe County, and all at cost or free. And that way we can keep cycling trees through there. So we may have removed roughly 100 trees, but over the next decade, we're going to create over 1,000 trees to help the canopy throughout the community.
Wow. And will these trees be like grown off of, away from the fairways, or just blended in with the trees that are existing there?
So they're in a couple different sites that we worked with Greenworks to figure out, but the first one, for example, is going to be off of number 17 fairway. So there's the fairway, the golf cart path, and then the tree nursery. So it's in what we you would call the rough. And so we'll plant them there and grow them, move them out. Really excited about that, because I truly think we're like the first golf course in the country to do it. And municipal golf courses have so much available land that's not used that if we can do this and start growing that project, it can become something really cool.
Yeah, I think a criticism of golf courses in general is that they use resources a lot, use a ton of water, yep. and the cutting down of trees. So I'm surprised that there's an effort here to give back in a sense or to replace the trees that were taken.
It makes sense. Like Asheville's a tree-friendly area. Like we do have a golf course and it needs to operate as a golf course and it hadn't been taken care of for so long, these trees just grew in. And so by removing them, I understand that's, you know, not the best thing in Asheville, but we can plant more and then make it a long-term thing that over time we're actually producing trees for the community, because trees are only going to get more expensive and harder to plant. And we worked with our city arborist and said, what trees do you need? And those are the types of trees that we're going to be planting. So it's not going to be just a sea of dogwoods. It's going to be a mix of the types of trees they need throughout the community.
You mentioned that the course itself is being restored to its original with the bunkers, taking out sand traps that weren't part of the original. How old is this course?
It was open in 1927.
Almost a century. So what's the significance? I think that's great to return to the original. Why is that important?
So Donald Ross courses were all designed in the teens to 30s. So they're all getting pretty old. And over time, course operators, owners, country clubs renovated and changed them based on how the play has changed, right? So back then they didn't have golf carts. They had what they called hickory shaft clubs. So like they couldn't hit the ball as far. And so golf has changed a lot in that century, but there's very few courses that are the original design. And a bonus of ours not really being taken care of for decades was that we didn't do a lot of changes over the years because we didn't have money to do it. And so restoring it back to original was a lot less expensive here than many other Donald Ross courses. And so it provides this destination, which is again, a goal. Like we want to bring in visitors to use this course to help supplement local rates. So we want local rates to stay down by using visitor rates at higher rates and having a reason for them to want to come to Asheville and play this course specifically because it is what Donald Ross designed. It all ties together, right?
Yeah. Lastly, Thomas Wolfe Auditorium is a big thing. I know you've told me there's not much movement, but some things have happened. Some repairs have happened. Yep. Talk about what's been repaired so far.
Yeah. So we reopened March 16th with a nearly sold out show and no issues. And we're plugging forward, right? We got a lot of dates moving, but we have not fully repaired yet the HVAC system, but we've repaired it enough to be able to do full capacity shows. We updated about 150 feet of sewer lines that had failed over time, renovated two restrooms, renovated the lower lobby. Those restrooms in that lower lobby of the Thomas Wolfe tie in with the arena, and so they're used for both buildings, so it made sense to really get into that. We did some plaster repair. We did some seat cleaning. It's not going to look tremendously different when you come in. So I don't want people to think that we like did this grand renovation, because we didn't. We repaired things. We upgraded these three spaces, the lobby and the two restrooms. And then we just did a lot of cleaning and really tried to like get it back up to snuff. But the building's old, right? So it still has a lot of the same look to it for sure.
By doing these repairs, does this in a way open up room to forestall more significant renovations? Like I can see where we patched it up, we're getting people back in and we're having events, and to do the renovations that need to be happening, it's going to cost many millions of dollars, and gosh, we just can't do it. Let's just keep patching it back together. Is that a very real possibility?
Certainly, right? Like it has been in the past. This is just the first time it got so bad that we had to close, which I think really kickstarted some momentum. Like I've been a part, this is probably my fourth time that this has risen up of we got to do something about the Wolf. And this is the first time, I didn't realize it those other three times, but this is the first time that it feels real. Those other times I thought it felt real, but it turns out it wasn't even close to real.
You mean in terms of just because you actually had to close this time?
Yeah, I think that's what like kicked it off with like certain elected officials, just community members. Like we've got like large business owners that are reaching out that are saying like, hey, I want to help make it happen this time. In the past, it's been the city needs to get off the duff and do this. But now we're getting like private individuals, other government agencies, like state representatives reaching out like, hey, how do we do this? We want to make this happen this time because it needs to happen, which is different.
Now, McCormick Field to date is the most expensive, most ambitious project by the city. Renovating Thomas Wolfe would dwarf McCormick Field, wouldn't it?
It would triple or quadruple it. Yes.
Yeah. And you're saying there's a lot of support. People and businesses are rallying around. What would need to happen to make renovations something like, yes, we can schedule this, we can put a timeline on this?
We've had a lot of conversations with groups in Charlotte, Durham, Atlanta, other groups that have successfully pieced something like this together. And so what I've learned in the last 6-9 months is complication is key, which is surprising. Like I, for the last X number of years, I was always trying to like, how do we make this deal as simple as possible to get this through? And what I'm learning is that the more hands that are in the deal, the better chance it doesn't fall apart. So even if it's super complicated and there's 20 different entities and everybody has a little piece in, it's a lot harder for the deal to fall apart if one group backs out. So the long-winded answer to that is getting as many different agencies involved as possible, financially and just like publicly committed to we want to do something. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a renovation of the Wolf. It could be like we should build a new theater or performing arts center somewhere else in town and then change the Wolf to support the arena, right? I'm not saying that's going to happen, but it could be anywhere from renovate / do nothing to the Wolf to that and anywhere in between. And it's really going to depend on what groups really want to get in and not. And it can't just be the city and the symphony.
Yeah, I can imagine that on one hand, by having a number of groups, you said the more that are in, the likelihood that this will happen, there's more buy-in. But doesn't that also put more chefs in the kitchen? Everybody with a voice and a different idea about what needs to happen?
I had a really similar question to somebody that just did a $85 million project in Charlotte with the Carolina Theater. And the answer was yes, that's true. But if they don't have buy-in and they don't get to have an opinion, why do they want to give you money?
But so it comes with a condition. So right. Yes, we need the money. Yes, we want your money. Now, okay, what do you want to say about this?
The Asheville Lyric Opera is too small to play in a room our size. But let's say the opera group is big enough. If we want to come to them and say, hey, can you chip in $1 million or whatever? Like they're going to want guaranteed X number of dates to do shows.
Sure, of course. Right.
So like how many different pieces can you put together for something like that? Or if it's a, let's pick on Duke Energy, right? If Duke wants to support the facility, they need to give us X number of dollars per year for so many years. And what can we provide? Maybe it's the Duke Energy stage or whatever it is, right? We need to be able to give and take, and it becomes like a weird private sector style deal done by the city in conjunction with a quasi with the TDA. Like it can just get really complicated really quickly. But apparently that's what leads to success.
Wow. So in the meantime, you're back to throwing events. Mm-hmm. Do you just hold your breath every event to make sure nothing happens tonight?
So we've only had one since we reopened. But yes, I went like in and out of the seats probably 5 times just to make sure it was comfortable. And it was actually like borderline chilly a couple times. Yeah, like the Wolf had been like that for a couple years that I was always like, what's going to break? You didn't know what it was going to be, but it was always going to be something. And everything went off splendidly with our first show. We expected that in 9 months, we figured somebody would forget how to do their job and it would really affect the show, right? And it was great. And it was a good night.
I want to thank my guest today, Chris Coral, General Manager and Director of Community and Regional Entertainment Facilities for the City of Asheville. Our conversation happened at the BB Theater in downtown Asheville, which comes to me courtesy of the Asheville Contemporary Dance Theater and Susan and Giles Collard. If you value the Overlook's place in Asheville's media landscape, please consider joining dozens of others who are supporting the show through my Patreon crowdfunding page. Become a member for as little as $5 a month. Visit patreon.com/theoverlookpodcast. Our First Look newsletter gives you just a handful of daily headlines from around the local media landscape to get you on your morning. We also have a weekly newsletter devoted to all things The Overlook that hits you every Friday. Both are free and available at podavl.com/newsletter. The theme song for The Overlook, Maker's Song, comes to us courtesy of the Asheville duo The Resonant Rogues. The Overlook is a production of Podcast Asheville. New episodes come out every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on any social media channel at AVL Overlook. And I'll see you on the next episode of The Overlook with Matt Pikin. Hey everyone, Matt Pikin here from The Overlook, and I'll get back to my conversation in just a moment. But I'm asking you, the listener, yes, you, listening this very moment, is The Overlook making a difference in your connection to Asheville? Do you know more about what makes this city tick and where we're struggling? If you had to give up one cup of coffee every month to do your part to keep this show going, would you step up? If you answered yes to any of that, and I really hope you did, please join dozens of other listeners by supporting The Overlook with Matt Pikin through my Patreon campaign by giving just $5 a month. Give at higher levels and you'll earn free tickets to my live podcasting events. Your support means the world to me and helps keep this show free for anyone to hear. Go to patreon.com/theoverlookpodcast.